Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Breakfast with Boz being served by Wahoo. I'm your host, Ian Boswell. A very, very special breakfast this morning. For those of you who don't know, my wife is a French teacher at the local high school. So in preparation for a fun little day with her students, we are practicing making some crepes this morning. Gretchen, how you've lived in France. How is this crepe compared to some of the galettes and crepes you've had in France?
Yeah, I lived in France with you, didn't I? I studied abroad in Nantes, where galette, the buckwheat crepe, is very popular. But we made the classic just plain flour crepe this morning so we could have some sweet crepes. I haven't had a bite yet, so I don't know how it compares. But we did a little bit of cheddar cheese, some caramelized onions from our rice bowls last night, and arugula and an egg. And we'll also do some sweet stuff. We've got some Nutella out here and some raspberry jam too for a sweet crepe.
Well, we've got a stack of crepes to get through, so I'll get working on those and you all sit back, relax, and get ready for another episode of Breakfast with Boz being served by Wahoo. In the episode today, I am joined by Reed McKelvin and Eric Fostvet, who I worked with while racing at Axelmerx's development team way back in the day. Both of these men have since left the team as I have, but we reflect on some wonderful memories together. But more importantly, we try and dive in to what fostering development looks like. Are there certain traits and characteristics that can be identified for young riders who then go on to do great things? In light of Theo Gegenhardt's victory at the Vuelta, Joao Almeida's extended period of time in the pink jersey, what characteristics and traits can be seen at a young age for riders that go on and achieve so much success? It's a packed episode, so I won't take too much time here setting it up. But before we do start today's episode, I want to let you all know there's another opportunity for you to join me on Breakfast with Boz. If you head over to wahoofitness.com, click the Discover tab, click Breakfast with Boz, and there you will find a very short survey where I'm trying to find out what are your goals and ambitions for 2021. If you fill out that short survey, I'll get in touch with you and get you on the show. So please, let's all gear up for 2021. Get ready for a year in which we hope we can get back to racing and events. And now, today's episode, starting off with my good friend, Reed McKelvin. I am joined by Reed McKelvin. Reed and I go way back to, before I actually ever worked with Reed on Trek Livestrong and then Bontrager Livestrong. But Reed, thanks for coming on the show.
Of course. Super happy to be here.
Well, you and I think we first met maybe at Cascade Cycling Classic in 2010. I was at Bissell. You were with the Livestrong guys. I think Finney was there and Dowsett, Ben King, maybe Jesse Sergeant. You had worked in cycling prior to working with the development team, but what drew you to come and work with young riders and you know, development riders in particular?
Yeah. So I was in the military for a while, and the whole time I was there, I was really, I just loved cycling. I, you know, used to race a little bit and just found it so interesting that you could be from anywhere in the world and compete in this sport, which is not true of most sports, right? Like you could be the strongest, fastest guy in Liechtenstein, but you're not going to get on the Dallas Cowboys, right? Chances are, because you have no chance to show yourself.
Exactly.
But in cycling, you do. You know, there's numerous events around the world and power files and all that stuff. So I always thought it was so interesting that someone from the smallest country in the world could be the biggest in a sport that their country has no history in. But anyways, yeah, so I got out of the Army. The day I got out of the Army, I got on a train and moved to Boulder, Colorado, because that's where cyclists lived. And I thought I wanted to do, I did want to do the whole pro thing and work with pros. And it was so cool. And I had, 4,000 issues of Velo News in my apartment and all that stuff. And anyway, so I started working locally with a lot of the Boulder pros, like Will Frischkorn and Chris Baldwin and Christian Vandeveld and all those guys. And then got me opportunities on teams. And I started working with teams. And then finally, in 2009, I made it to the big leagues. I got on, which was then Garmin at the time. And I'd worked for them for years since their first year, part-time, helping out wherever I could when I was in school. And then I went over and I did a combination of World Tour and then their amateur slash Conti Devo team, and then worked with their juniors. So I had this, and I realized that I didn't want to get yelled at for not having a raspberry gel when I could, you know, I gave some juniors some extra socks and one of them hugged me, you know, and their parents were appreciative and the kids were so appreciative of the, you know, the, because everything at Garmin trickled down to each kid, you know, so like last year's bikes became your bike on the Devo team. And then 2 years ago's bikes or some odd size that no one else had went to the juniors for some kid who would, it would fit. Right. And it was just such an amazing experience. So I'd go over and do Catalunya. I'd come back and I'd do Gila and, you know, sleep on the floor of a hotel room with, you know, seven junior or seven Devo kids and cook in a hot pot and rice cooker. And it was just so much more rewarding. I don't know if that's just the right term, but just, it, you know, I've always kind of been passion driven. And so that just made more sense to me. And it was amazing. And so I had already talked to Axel the year before about working for him, but he didn't have enough money for full time. And I'd suggested some riders to him, you know, and those riders ended up working out, you know, like I'd seen Ben King at the U23 Tour of Pennsylvania, the American Eagle, or no, Abercrombie and Fitch, one of those two, Tour of Pennsylvania. And Ben was there on Kelly Benefit's amateur team and, you know, and just made some suggestions. And then the next year he had enough money and listened to me and brought me on full time, which full circle brings it back to you because, and you and I have talked about this before, but I think it's funny. So we had three spots left on the team. Well, sorry, we had two spots left on the team and three people. So I knew Gavin Mannion from, cause I worked cross with TIA Crafts development team, the Cliff Bar Cyclocross Devo team. So I knew Gavin from cross. Nate at the time was the third or fourth ranked junior in the world. And then I had heard of this other kid from Oregon a little bit, but I knew the other two kids better. So Axel goes, who do you think? And I go, well, I know that kid. I know that kid. So I guess, I don't know, those two. And he's like, all right. And that's the year Ian went to Bissell. Long story short.
Yeah. But I, we,
but that worked out pretty well.
It did. Yeah. Well, I mean, and
it worked out really well.
Well, and it's something that I was wanted to ask, you know, cause you know, we worked together at a very unique time in, I guess, of any rider who you'd worked with, you know, they're at a point in their life where they're really hungry to try and make it. And, you know, having worked with pro riders and then having worked with development riders, did you notice a different kind of mindset where, you know, where the young riders may be more teachable and they listen more, a bit more patient? Did you find that to be like a common trait across working with young riders rather than, you know, with kind of seasoned pros and veterans?
Right. Yes. And that was one of the things that kept me into it and kept me going and wanting to just do everything I can for you guys from all over the world. Cause you know, I looked at it as such a, cause when you sign on for a job, which is also what you guys did, obviously, cause you signed a contract, but you sign on for a job. Like right now, if I signed a job to go work in Russia in the oil field, I'm an adult and I know what I'm getting into, you know? And then, so like when I signed for a pro team and then I have, you know, Tom Danielson, exactly the same distance from a paper towel dispenser that I am. And he asked me to pull one off for him, and then waits there until I do it for him, even though he could easily do it. And then, like I said, I go with you guys and, you know, give you food and you're like, so psyched to get that someone brought you lunch. It's like, you know, you won the lottery, you know, it's, just the attitude. It was so, that's why it was so easy every day to do it, because every time you guys would do something, you'd finish top 20, we'd get a jersey for a day or two. You know, you would see that, even just see the physical progression of like, oh wow, that guy wasn't as good at camp. And now he's where he wants to be, you know, and you could, and then you could see their personality and, you know, the confidence grow in them. And then you just did your best to reinforce it, you know, and get them to where they need to be. But also, as you know, I was a bit of a realist with stuff too, just because I didn't want to, you know, you don't want to tell the kid who can't finished Sunset Loop in Redlands that he's going to Team Sky next year.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and at that age, you know, and especially, you know, at that point in time, when you look at, you know, the crop of, you know, riders that I came up with Nate and, you know, Jesper Stuyven and Lawson Craddock. And then, you know, following me, you know, we saw Teo and a bunch. I mean, the team became very international, and, you know, the kids who are on the team who maybe are, you know, a step behind, they're seeing all the riders around them, you know, taking this huge step up to the world tour and kind of making it big time. It can be challenging if you're, you know, kind of just one notch below those riders, because you're still a phenomenal cyclist, but right, you know, you're maybe not quite at the same level as those guys.
Yeah. And that's what's hard to realize that. And that's what I tried to do. And that's one of the reasons I got involved with Everybody's Life that I could, to help with agents, because, you know, a lot of the, you know, like you had an agent, you know, pretty quick, early on, obviously. But some of those, you know, guys one step below that didn't. And then no one cares about those guys, even though they're fine athletes and could be good pros and have a 15-year career. But everybody just wants, like, the kid who was second in Liège, you know?
That's
the
me.
Kid who got the best, you know, who beat this. Yeah, no, but I mean, really, right? I mean, that's how it works.
Yeah.
Because you see the shiny things. And deservedly so, right? I mean, that's how life works. Like, you know, you don't go, I don't know, man, that kid's like, I mean, he's like the 87th ranked quarterback in the country. We should sign, you know, that's just life. But a lot of those guys that were in that spot have continued on and had really great careers. I remember Alex Dowsett, he was so scared of getting a pro ride when he was with us. Cause he, you know, he did, you know, we had a team house in Boulder and he's living there at Timmy Rowe, Jesse, Ben King, Australia. And they're just, Alex is sitting there just doing everything for Finney every race. And he's, you know, having good TTs. And he's just so worried about even making it. Like, do you think someone will offer me a minimum contract? And it's just so hard sometimes to explain to them that they're doing the right things, even though they're not winning and they're not, like, five agents aren't kicking down their door.
Yeah. I mean, and there was riders that we both saw coming through the team who we knew were, you know, phenomenal teammates, you know, someone like Ryan Eastman, who, you know, an exceptional teammate, but because he didn't have those results because he was so selfless, always riding for someone else, which was, he would have made a phenomenal rider in the World Tour, but because he didn't have those results, it made it challenging for him, you know, to get noticed when he needed to be noticed. And I guess that's something that, you know, I wanted to ask you, because you were, you know, we didn't really mention it, but you're a Soigneur, you're a Carer, you're the Papa Bear of the team, even more so, I mean, quite frankly, than Axel. Most of us riders came to you because we felt comfortable with you. We spent time with you, you know, in the van, on the massage table, you know, before the race, after the race. You know, we spent an incredible amount of time to you, and I feel like opened up to you probably more than anyone in the organization. Are there certain characteristics of the riders who have gone on to, you know, be successful that you've worked with? You know, let's look at Stuyven. You know, Teo just won the Giro. Yes. Dowsett won a stage. Almeida. You know, there's so many riders who you've worked with who are now at the top of the World Tour winning. When you look back now, are there certain characteristics that those riders displayed? Were they eager to learn? Were they confident? You know, what did those riders have in common that you noticed?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, you, for example, you know, you are so damn stubborn, and it's one of your great strengths, right? In your life.
In ways.
In ways. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Like anything else. Right. And same with Teo. I mean, Teo, like I told this story recently a little bit, but, like, you know, I try to follow every junior race in the world, or I did. Now I'm a little, it's a little harder, obviously, but I follow every junior race in the world, you know, big or small, and just kind of look for patterns and try to figure these guys out. And then I remember reading just one of the many British things I was reading about this young kid, and he'd been doing well and whatever. And I reached out to him on Facebook. I'm like, hey, bud, just keeping an eye on you. You know, my name's Reed. I'm, you know, the ops manager over here at, you know, oh God, what were we at the time? So it would have been Bontrager still. Yeah. And he's just like, oh yeah, really interested. Already planned on riding for you guys, kind of thing. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And not in a bad way, but I was like, oh man, this kid's focused. And then the next week he got on the podium at Junior Roubaix. And then right after that, you know, signed with Corso, and then came onto the team the next year. And like I said, did Tour of California as a first year, which, as you know, is our big, the team's biggest, Axel's team's biggest race of the year. So to be able to do that is pretty phenomenal, and you could see it. But the same with you, the same with Stuyven. I mean, you know, Stuyven was so dialed when he came to us already. And then he just, if anything, I think he just started to enjoy cycling a bit more because he saw he could have fun and joke around with you guys and, you know, eat French fries after a 6-hour ride, if that's what we had for lunch that day, and it wouldn't cost him a win 6 weeks down the line. And that's one of the reasons he wanted to come to us and get away from the Belgian, every Belgian team. He was a junior world champion, and he came to an American team, obviously Axel, to sort of grow and get out of his comfort zone a little bit and, you know, expand a little bit. And I think the same, you know, the same with Almeida. He was on a really good Italian Devo team and he came to us. You know, it's, you have to have that extra level of maturity to realize an opportunity to get outside your like you can go to the college, you can go to CU Boulder if you live in Boulder, right? But, you know, maybe you want to go to the University of Oregon because you know it's going to be a little better for you in the long run to get away from your family, get outside your comfort zone and grow as a adult. And that's challenging for a lot of people to do.
Yeah. Well, and how did you see, I mean, because you probably saw this more than I did when you have so many riders competing and, you know, let's say, I don't know, you're at Tour California and someone has a good result. You know, for example, we were there and Dombrowski rides well and other riders are maybe like, oh man, well now we have to work for him. How did you see that dynamic working? Do you think that competitive culture within the team when everyone's being successful raises the level of everyone? Or can you see certain riders kind of drift to the back and be like, oh, well, I'm struggling because, you know, other people are performing
so
well.
Yeah, it's not my day. Yeah, yeah. No, for sure. We definitely had that. But that was part of like the vetting process that we did with a lot of the guys. You know, like I tell you, like I used to talk to 5 different sources about every rider that I ever suggested to Axel. So I would talk to the rider himself, obviously. I would try to talk to the parents. I would talk to a coach. I would talk to a World Tour or Pro Conti guy from their country and then someone I knew, because by 6 degrees of separation, I always know somebody on a team, even if it's a small Conti team in Europe, about them. And then you get to, you know, because we had the, I don't know if you can swear on the podcast, but we had that no asshole policy on the team, you know, and we looked at, you know, we tried really hard with that. And then Axel talked to him and you know how he is. He's just so Axel and disarming and charming. And he just talks to you, you know, he's not sitting there and like, what do you weigh? Where's your pal? Send me that. He's not doing that. He's like, hey, bud. Yeah, I was just, you know, looking at you and your good results and let's talk, you know, and then he gets a feel for people that way. And it was challenging. I spent a lot of time. You said, you know, we talked a lot earlier about that. But, you know, when the guys were on the table and I was working on them, you know, I'd go, oh, how was your day, bud? You know, he'd go, oh, you know, Rider X would go, oh, yeah, it was good. You know, I did my thing. And you could tell they're a little disappointed on how, I cannot think of any climbs in Tour of California right now.
Baldy.
Yeah, Mount Baldy. I was trying to think, I was saying Brasstown Bald, but that was Georgia. How Mount Baldy went. And they'd be like, yeah, you know, blah, blah. You know, and I'd be like, yeah, but, you know, Joe did this and the boys did this and that's good, man. You contributed and that, you know, that's why we're here. And, you know, don't worry, just stay the course. You'll get your chance and the season's long and you've already done this X, Y, and Z and you have 1 year left and, you know, next year it's going to be a different kind of setup and you reinforce all the positives, but you still address the negatives. And I think you guys all got along so well each year. We had such a good chemistry of all the years I was there that everybody worked for everybody. Cause like, for instance, even if you go back to Finney, that first year in Olympia's tour, we won 4 stages in the overall and went 1-2 in the overall. So after the first 2 stages and Taylor was ahead, you know, the other guys could have been like, oh, well, you know, maybe I should try to get in a break or something. You know, I need a pro contract too. Finney already has 10 offers. But no, everybody just kind of banded together and did what they were supposed to do. And it worked out. You know, Jesse got a pro contract out of that. I mean, we had 5 guys go World Tour that year. And 1 guy go Pro Conti.
So, yeah.
And that's what it is. It's just you have to, because at the end of the day, it is development and that's what's hard about it. But it's also your job. So you just have to, some very few times in the almost 10 years I was there, I had to remind somebody it was their job too. Most of the time it's like, hey, bud, your chance is going to be, you know, 2 weeks from now.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that I had a conversation with Brailsford a couple of years into my Team Sky contract when I was underperforming based off of kind of what I had expected of myself and what the team had expected. And, you know, I was like, oh, I don't have any opportunities. And, you know, that's not an excuse when you're racing so many days a year. It's, you know, if you don't think you have opportunities, it's because you're not ready to embrace an opportunity when it's laid out before you. And I think that's a very powerful thing for young riders to realize and, you know, kind of embrace, is that, you know, opportunities happen. You just have to be seeking them and ready when they fall in your lap.
Right. And not to argue with Sir Brailsford, but back then you guys didn't do as many of the 2.1s either.
No, a lot of big,
a lot of training and writing a big race was like, Ian, why didn't you seize the opportunity on the hardest day of Catalunya when you've had 4 days of racing this year so far?
Yeah.
And that's one of the things. So one of the things Ineos have done more recently, like Tao and Sivakov, it's like last year, what clicked, you know, helped Tao click over was when he won in that, not Coppi Bartali.
Oh, Tour of the Alps.
Yeah. It just, you know, it just like, bing, oh crap, I can do it. You know, I'm not always working for G or Froome or whatever. And all of a sudden it's like, wow. And then, you know, team rallies behind you and, you know, and they're investing in youth and just do that. And you're like, wow. And that's a huge part of it. And that's where, you know, a lot of teams have gotten away from doing that and racing the quote unquote smaller races. But that's the way guys make the next step up. Because if you're just getting your D kicked in, you know, 55 days a year at the world tour level. And then it's the end of 2 years and you did your job every day. Like, what are you going to do next? You know, like, I did my job. Well, yeah, 25 other guys did their job too. How do you show that? But if you get those even limited opportunities to show a little bit more, it's going to set you apart from your other peers that are also looking for jobs.
Yeah, no, that's completely true. And that's, you know, that is one thing that can be challenging from when riders kind of step up from development to a world tour team and then they're just working and they don't have an opportunity to win, they kind of forget or lose that instinct of how to win races. And they're kind of just going through the motions and you're right. They're doing their job. They're helping the team, but they're not, you know, they've been winners as development riders and they go to the world tour and they forget what it's like to win. And that's, you know, can be dangerous, but, you know, fortunately riders like Tao and Almeida and more of these world tour teams are understanding that the young guys need to keep racing to win. So they remember that feeling.
Yeah. No, and that's it. And that's why one of the reasons I loved our program so much is because we did, you know, U23 Liège and the Baby Giro and the Tour of California. And then we also did Gila and Joe Martin and all these other really hard, difficult races because the teams are so strong and they're shorter. So in a way, sometimes you have to be even more exceptional to be able to get a result there, right? Because how do you drop somebody when the stage is 110K long, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's less selective.
Right? Like what you guys did in Gila that last year you were on the team, you and Lawson. I mean, you know, you had a guy that was on the podium of the Tour de France chasing you, you know, and you guys went 1-2. And that's not easy to do in a race where all the directors have done that race 10 times already and know exactly how it's going to play out, you know?
Well, it's funny you actually mentioned that stage because that was – when, you know, people, when I decided to retire from road cycling, people are like, oh, do you have any regrets? And you'll remember, well, it was the last stage of Gila. I bridged across to Lawson and I think, was it Chad Beyer was up there? And we knew we were going to win. And Lawson came to me and he's like, hey, Ian, like, you know, let me win the stage because I've already been out in the breakaway and I'd already been on, you know, had some decent results that spring. I was like, okay, cool. Like you'll win and I'll come second. And I crossed the line. I think like the first thing you said to me is like, Ian, never give a victory away. And I think I wound up finishing that season with, you know, 4 or 5 second places and I didn't win a stage or a race. And so sorry, Lawson, but I wish I would have hit you on the line there because I probably could have.
Yeah. No, it's hard. And that's what I mean. But that's part of what made that team so great, you know, is moves like that, even if they're regrettable now. And, you know, Eastman and, you know, Nate and Gavin and just like, you know, everybody just letting their own results go. Like, for instance, when we won, Vol 2013, even won a stage and we rode for Stuyven the rest of the time. And in reality, I mean, he shouldn't even been kind of top 10 because it was basically, he's a classics guy and we're in Portugal. You know, and friggin' Nate and Gavin and Eastman and the guys are all rotating at the front, just killing themselves. And we eked it out. And that was, Jasper's first stage race win. And it was incredible. And like the feeling that day was just unbelievable in the team. And then, like, you know, we're sitting there at the hotel afterwards, packing up to leave like we do, you know, because we're a small team out of there. And friggin', you know, Eastman's falling asleep eating because he's so tired, you know? And just like, man, you know, sitting on the curb in the sunlight, loading our bags in a truck, and, you know, guys are falling asleep laying on each other, you know? And they're like, holy crap. Yeah. But like, but that's what made the team so special. And that's what we really tried to do. Like, I would take that over being the Ineos equivalent of a development team, or like how Rabobank Conti was, where they, there was one of the years during the bad years of cycling where Rabo Divo, they won something like, it was like 60 something percent of every race they entered. It was astronomical because they had so many good guys. And I would rather be on a team that won 5 races and did stuff like that than a team that won 30 races and did stuff like that. You know, it was amazing to see that. And that's what I see. The only problem I see with development now is people want to give less of a chance even before than they do to the Ryan Eastmans and, you know, all the, it, like, well, Ben had a pretty phenomenal year, but, you know, the workers, the strong worker guys, than they do now. They want everybody to be Remco, you know? Yeah. They're like, oh, that kid's 22 and he's only won 2 races. Yeah, I don't know, you know? Yeah. It's really scary now. And I have agents tell me the same thing, that they don't want to sign quote unquote normal riders anymore, because then every year they're having to, bust their butts to find them another normal job, you know, like a $50,000 a year. Like, yeah, we like you, Steve, we'll renew you kind of position. You know, they all want the Remcos and the Teos and the Sivakovs and all that stuff. But yeah, it's challenging. Yeah, By the way, I picked Sivakov for the team too. We were just Axel passed, so I just like to throw that in Axel's face every time I can. It's development's just, it's the most amazing thing I've ever been a part of in my life. It's so great to see, you know, these kids. I mean, we had, when I left the team, we had 7, I'd worked with 7 riders from 17 different countries. Development riders by that point.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's just cool. The fact that we did, you know, that was one of the things I liked about us. And that was part of what I did to Axel all the time. Like, I wouldn't talk to him about, we would talk about Americans and we would talk about other stuff, but I'd always be like, okay, I got this Latvian. Okay. I got this Estonian kid. You know, I was like, there's this kid out of Ireland. I was always just trying to get non-traditional countries on the team, because I think it helped counterbalance some of the, you know, American arrogance sometimes. Yeah. You know,
and it changes the dynamic of the team. It makes it, you know, it also prepares the American riders to go to an international team, because they're like, oh, I've raced with a Portuguese guy before and I understand some of their cultures and customs and Italian guy or whatever it is. And then, you know, that's incredibly, incredibly powerful for any young person to be exposed to, you know, a dynamic and diverse environment.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what helps you grow. I mean, that was, you know, I'm from a small town in upstate New York of like 5,000 people. And I went into the army, you know, and my first roommate was like a kid from South Central Los Angeles that was literally like, you know, go to war or go to jail kind of thing with a judge, you know, and he was, you know, and it just, all that kind of exposure helps widen your worldview and makes your world a more interesting place, if nothing else. Yeah. It just helps you learn and adapt to, you know, you think your stuff's hard or whatever, and then you realize like, oh no, that's really hard. You know, like, I volunteered to be here. I wanted to be here. And this kid's like, you can go to jail or you could join the military. And whoa. And then, oh, he's got a family back home and his sister has 2 kids and he's making $800 a month and he sends money home to help with that. So yeah, bud, I can buy you lunch today, you know, and then, and that kind of stuff. And that's, you know, why I love the sport, going back to the beginning, so much, is because of what you're saying. The, you know, I worked on Toyota United and at one point we had 9 different countries on the team at the same time, you know, and everybody's sitting there at dinner having just the best time in the world, telling stories. And then you would see the Serbian guy didn't like this food because, you know, it would make him fat. But then the Cuban guy's eating 3 helpings of it. And then, and then Baldwin's asking for his dressing on the side. And then this is happening and everybody's laughing and having a good time and talking about their experiences. And it brought everybody together more versus if you're just all on an American team and everybody just goes back, it's just like having a job to a degree, I think sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, go back to your hotel room, talk to your wife, girlfriend, whatever. And then like, you know, put your headphones on and you guys just sit there until you go to bed.
Well, yeah. The last thing I want to ask you, you've kind of already alluded to it, but you know, having spent so much time with these young riders from around the world and some of the, you know, best up and coming riders who at the time were, you know, winning, but are now winning the biggest races in the world. What did you learn from them over the 10 years plus of working with development riders?
Yeah, so much. It's hard to sort of put a pin on it, but you know, I think one of the things you learn, and I struggle with this a bit in the military and leadership positions, is you basically had to, not everybody's going to do what you do in that exact same situation. And you have to be open to differing opinions about those kind of things. So like you and I would not bump heads is the wrong term, but that's the closest thing.
Yeah, no, we definitely didn't always see eye to eye, but I feel like, yeah, but we mutually respected each other's whether choice or opinion, but didn't necessarily always agree.
Right, exactly. And that's hard sometimes when you're older and have done, you know, been around and done things and you've got a 19-year-old telling you like, no, man, let me tell you about this.
That was definitely me.
And you're like, right. But, you know, like I used to say, don't mistake kindness for weakness. Like I'll, read you a bedtime story, tuck you in, but I will SF you if you, you know, mess up. But yeah, so and just all the different cultures and just the attitudes and the just learning. It was just so amazing to be exposed to these kids and be a part of their lives. And I just learned so much about even myself and like what was important to me, because I like really liked doing development. And then I would go home and I would work my other job when I was not on the road. And like, for instance, we would go and we'd do our, you know, 4-week, 5-week Europe trip in the spring. And I would stay at the U.S. national team house, you know, and work the Nations Cup in between with you guys, you know, between action races. And it was, I'd go home and I'd be like, holy crap, I was just gone for 5 weeks and 5 days. And I would go to my job the next day that I did when I was home. And by like noon the first day, I was like, oh my God, get me out of here.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It just felt like time is staying. That week I was home took 6 times as long as being gone for 5 weeks, you know, working that quote unquote normal job. So I learned a lot from the kids and you know, it also taught me to believe in myself a little bit sometimes, because when someone has like blind faith in their abilities because of the work they've put in, it's empowering. You know, you have someone like Teo, it's just like, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. And you're like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. When I think, I think, kind of to wrap it up here, I think Teo in particular was someone that, you know, when he was at Action, then when he was at Team Sky, he had this sense of, I don't want to say arrogance, more confidence, but at the time when he was 21 years old, 22, like people at Team Sky were kind of like, really, this kid's going to say that, or he's going to act like that. But he internally, he knew what he wanted to do. And you know, he had the ability, and clearly he's, you know, gone on and become the second ever British rider to win the Giro. And now no one's questioning him. And it's phenomenal to see that he had so much confidence and belief in himself and didn't let anyone sidetrack him to get to where he wanted to go.
Yeah. Because with all that, you know, I still can't say I would ever know what it would take to win a Grand Tour as far as like being able to predict that. Right. Because how many guys have we seen that you're like, oh, my God, he's going to win every race for the next 10 years. And he wins a few and then nothing happens. And then another guy that you're like, yeah, he's pretty good, you know, dominates, you know, and so on. But yeah, Teo just was so incredible with his focus and his belief. And same thing, like you and I, you were saying, we would agree to disagree on some things. And I would ride him pretty hard about those things. You know, like I had a helmet rule on the team and Teo hated to wear his helmet to sign on because he wanted to wear his little peaked cap, Rafa style. You know? So then he would acquiesce and he would, you know, put his helmet on, but not do the straps down, you know, or he'd put his helmet on, ride to the stage, take his helmet off, put the cap back on. You know what I mean? Just like, just all these things. And it was just like, you know, and that was just his way of being in control of that moment, which helped him focus for his goal of that day. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Yep.
And no, that's hard at the time. Cause I'm just like, bro, there's 8 of you, 7 kids can do it. you know, all this, the eight other kids for the previous 10 years have done it. Just clipped a little snappy. I can even do it for you, you know? He'd be like, oh, right. And he would ride 10 meters, unclip it, do his thing. And then, you know, come back and just give me a little sheepish grin or whatever. And he was also really a leader too, even from year one, you know, he would, you know, like, I'd always be on you guys about laundry or, you know, picking up the van or whatever. And Taylor would be like, just right. You know, he'd like pull guys aside and be like, right guys, how hard is it to just take your wet clothes and put them in the zipper bag that the nice man provides to you and then drop it into the laundry basket that the nice man provides for you and then have it brought back to your room later that day clean. It's not asking a lot, you know?
No.
And he did little things like that throughout his time there. And, as did all of you in one way or another, but he would always, he'd be the first one to just be like, to collectively to the group, like, don't be wits, just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and he's, you know, he's clearly gone on to be a team leader. So, hey, Reed,
yep.
On behalf of all the riders you've worked with over the years, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And yeah, obviously it's been a crazy year, but it would be great to do some type of reunion at some point. I've talked to some of the other riders and it'd be great to get together and I don't know, maybe we can all go paintballing again or something when we're allowed.
That would be amazing. Thanks for having me in. I really appreciate it. Miss you. I hope life's good over there and on the East Coast and that the missus is good and all that.
All's well, Reed. Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye.
I am joined by Eric Fostvedt. Eric, how you doing?
I'm great. Ian, it's good to hear from you again.
Yeah, it's been a while. Well, we first became acquainted at the Livestrong team, I think Trek Livestrong in 2011, and then Bontrager Livestrong in 2012, right?
2012, you're early. 2012 was the year I started. So I joined the team like right before tour of Gila in 2012.
Good memories back then. I've hit my head too many times to remember specific dates and details, but
To be fair, I was looking at the website. And
good. Well, you know, I mean, we're speaking today about, you know, you've played such an instrumental role in so many young riders' development, and you were at Livestrong went through different iterations of teams and names, but I guess under Axel Merckx's kind of organization, and you've had the chance to work with some riders who have gone on to achieve phenomenal results. You know, Teo just won the Giro, and Stuyven's, you know, become a classics, you know, huge, mm-hmm. you know, dominating factor in the classics. And so I guess what I'm trying to hear from you and your perspective as a mechanic at the time at that team is kind of what you observed being there. And I guess we'll start off by how did you kind of get involved with working with a development team?
It wasn't really that I was headed towards a development team. It was just kind of that trying to find a path in professional cycling. I knew I loved bicycles. I had a passion for it. I knew that I loved working on bicycles and I knew I loved racing. So I went from, you know, I grew up in Boulder, Colorado. I worked in bike shops for as long as I could and went from that into actually did a quick stint with Toyota United, which is where I met Reed McAlvin for the first time. And I'm sure we'll come to more conversations about him as we go through this. But, you know, so that's sort of where it started. And then I got a job with Slipstream Sports, which was the TIA. It's Jonathan Vodder's company that took TIA Cref over to Europe that year into a pro continental status. I was there for 6 years and I ended up meeting Axel at a couple European races on the ground when I was working with the U23 team from Slipstream. That was where we were Chipotle for a while and Slipstream Chipotle and things like that. And yeah, it just kind of came to pass that I was the timing worked out. I was looking for a job. Axel was looking for a mechanic and we connected and started that adventure in 2012.
Well, what is it, you know, you'd had experience working with pro teams and riders, you know, bike shops, all sorts of, you know, come across different riders, different levels. What was it like working with, you know, that group of young riders? Cause you know, you and I, we work closely together and, you know, Axel's team and the riders are, you know, of the, you know, kind of the cream of the crop, you could say. What sort of personalities did you find on that team? Did you find the riders to be, you know, cause I mean, to kind of elaborate here, being a mechanic it's a tough job. You know, you're the first person to wake, last person to bed. During the day, you're always doing something. And for a bunch of, you know, picky and sometimes, you know, cocky 21-year-olds. You know, they have high expectations. You know, how did you find working with those young riders compared to other people in cycling?
Well, I mean, I think the first important part of it is just that the leadership that Axel gave that team from the top down was so hugely instrumental in the way that it operated. He's just, I mean, Axel's an outstanding human being. He's got such great knowledge. His mentality is always positive. And he's a great leader. He's a great coach. He's a great director. So, you know, when the top of the pyramid has a mentality like Axel did, it's pretty easy for it to trickle down and be a really, really great experience for everybody. You know, and then he built a really successful team. And I mean, like the track record shows for it. I mean, almost half of the riders that went through that program have gone on to the world tour. So, you know, when he would go and collect riders or assign riders, like I was in the best position ever because I knew that every kid coming into that team had a great deal of potential and some kind of talent that Axel saw. And so it was really interesting to me just to be there and watch the different personalities come because, I mean, we had guys that were, like you said, I mean, we had the guys that were super picky and, you know, maybe a little bit entitled and used to having everything their way and getting everything the way they wanted it. And we had guys who had literally never worked with a professional mechanic before because they were super talented and just hadn't been in the pipeline of cycling. And so they were super new to it. So, I mean, that was one of the best experiences of the whole thing for me was just watching how the different personality types affected the team and the way they raced and the way they became teammates. And then watching the kids that, you know, would have great success. And they're really, you know, I was thinking about it, like, what are the great predictors, right? Like what is it that makes one kid better than the other, or makes one guy more of a chance to make it to the top level? And it's really almost impossible to say, you know, cause like, when you look at the different personality types, you know, throughout the different years, like you mentioned Jasper, you know, I mean, there's a guy who's just super stoic. He had a great background, a great experience before he joined the team. You know, he knew where he was headed. You know, Teo was a guy like that, like super driven, super, you know, just had his focus on right. And was always looking at the stuff that he could do to be better, you know, and then there was a guy like Lawson was at the time, you know, Lawson was a pretty like footloose, fancy free, like, you know, really just was enjoying it, you know, like wasn't so hyper-focused on what the next step was and getting there, more just being there and enjoying his time with his teammates and racing. And it ended up, you know, that he had great success coming out of it. I think that the really important thing about it at the end was just that, like, we weren't focused on results. That was never the driving motivation for the team. You know, the environment that was created was one of like, let's learn. If we make mistakes, let's learn from them. Let's go out and have fun racing our bikes and get better at it. And then kind of the results just kind of started trickling down from there.
So when you look back at, you know, all the different riders you just mentioned that you worked with, were there any riders that were very involved with their bikes and the mechanic side of it and would, you know, come out to the truck and say, hey, Eric, like, can we adjust this or change this? Or, you know, is there anyone that was hyper focused on the technology side of it or the equipment side? Cause I mean, as we well know that, you know, that is come so far in the last few years and it, especially when it comes to like a time trial or something like, you know, Paris-Roubaix and like the equipment is so important. How involved were the riders with kind of with you and making those decisions and kind of advising you on what they wanted, but also you sharing your experience on like, hey, this is actually going to be a better, you know, a better wheel or tire or handlebar for this event or that event.
Well, I mean, again, that was the best thing about that program was that all of the athletes were fairly young, right? And, you know, they were all learning in a sort of environment of professional, of a new environment of professional racing for them. So, you know, I think that there was a lot more conversation in that setting than there would be in like a world tour team, you know, because we had an opportunity to actually have a conversation. Like they'd, you know, we'd talk with the guys about what would work for this one and not work for that one and how we were going to set up tire pressures and how we were going to set up time trial bikes and do stuff like that. And really it was just that the mentality of the program was to learn and get better. And, you know, that came to me as well. You know, when the team went onto a specialized sponsorship, you know, that was a great situation for us. You know, they gave us access to their wind tunnel, and you know, while the team was developing athletes and riders, it was also a great opportunity for me to develop my skills and get better at what I was doing. You know, I think that, you know, I had a couple reality checks, like a couple humility checks pretty early on, and realized that, you know, like, the worst thing you can do is think you know everything, right? And so, you know, started my own education through that stuff. And like, yeah, there were definitely guys that, you know, like Mikkel Bjerg is a good example. Like, there's a guy who is specifically and wholly a time trial specialist. And that he was to the point of like being really difficult for me to work with, just because he was so tuned in on what he could do. And like, I mean, that was a situation where like you're pushing the limits of what the UCI will allow, and, you know, spending time in the wind tunnel talking about like, you know, how tall your socks are going to be and should you shave your legs the day before the time trial. Right. Like, so there were a few guys like him, you know, like Teo was like that too. Teo was a very like 1 millimeter saddle adjustments and things like that. You know, Logan Owen was pretty picky about his bikes. You know, it's so hard. There's so many riders that came through that program. And, you know, there were definitely guys that were more picky than others. There were guys that were just happy to be handed a clean bike every day. And then there were guys that really wanted to know everything and why and how and why we were doing stuff certain ways and how we could, you know, adjust the bike to fit them better, make them give them a better opportunity to have success. So it's hard to point fingers and name out a couple or one or two riders or anything like that. Cause it was all, you know, like, I think everybody at some point, it was a relationship thing, right? Like once a good relationship got developed, then it seemed like the riders got a little more picky with what they were talking about and thinking about, but it was so great for everybody involved. Cause it really was like a mutual growth thing, you know?
Well, did you find it at all, like when you have someone like Mikkel Bjerg, or I know I live with Will Barta in Nice, and he was, you know, another rider who's incredibly nice and genuine, but he really loves the aerodynamic side of things. Do you find it contagious over the years where one rider begins to really dial in something like, oh, I'm going to go to narrower handlebars, or I'm going to, you know, do this. And then all of a sudden everyone's coming to you the next day, or, you know, the night before the, you know, the time trial, like, hey, Eric, can you actually swap out my, you know, handlebar for this? Because, you know, someone else did it and he's been riding well. Did you find that, you know, situation often?
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely like, you know, we would say monkey see, monkey do, you know, so it's sort of like one guy gets an idea and it works out for him. And then everybody wants to kind of like ride that wave of success. Right. You know, so I think that it wasn't so much, I don't know, honestly, like when I think about it, I don't really think that there was a great, like, trickle down of people needing things, you know, like it was, that program was so well set up and the sponsors gave it such great support that we really had, there was really nothing left to want or ask for in that situation. And so it wasn't like, oh, we got this new handlebar that nobody's seen before, and now this guy has it, now everybody wants it. It was like, that stuff was just available to all the riders from day one. And that was a really great thing about that program, was we weren't like, well, we only have two of these handlebars and we have to pick which of the six guys get it. It was always, you know, we always had great access to equipment and everything we needed. So it made that part of the job super easy.
Yeah, I recall maybe it was 2012. We did Tour California. Because you were there. We had the black kits, and we had just been given the new SRAM Red group set. And I remember Tom Boonen had come up to me, because he didn't even have it. Quickstep didn't have the group set, and he came up to me and he was furious. He's like, why do you guys have this new group set? A bunch of, you know, 19, 20 year olds. And, you know, he's, you know, multi-time world champion, won Roubaix, and didn't have this new group set. But yeah, we were a pilot program, I guess, for testing it out. And it's awesome that, you know, at such a young age, you are able to have that opportunity to use that equipment.
Yeah. And again, I think that was a product of the situation, you know, like we did a lot of testing with SRAM, actually. Like, you know, we were pretty instrumental in helping them develop their ETAP stuff and getting that early into races and getting race miles on it. And a lot of back and forth with their engineers and their design team on how that stuff worked. And, you know, that I remember that year at California when they were walking around and those guys were coming over asking about it. And, you know, the reality of that situation is that there was a little bit less to risk there. You know, it's like, it's a different story if you put a brand new group set on a bike at a big race for a young guy who's, you know, the odds of him winning aren't as great as, say, Tom Bonin winning a sprint, you know. So there was, like, that was the great flexibility of that program. You know, we had a lot of room to work with the sponsors, you know, and I think that's some of the great value that program can give to these companies that are looking to develop products and, you know, get hard racing miles at a very high level, but not have it be on, you know, on the world champion's bike while they're testing it and making sure it's, you know, race ready and market ready and all of those things.
Yeah. Well, and you know, better than most that sometimes young boys can be really hard on equipment as well, you know, shifting gears while on a full sprint and, you know, jumping the cog. And yeah, it's a great place to test out equipment.
Absolutely.
Through your years of working there, is there something that you picked up from riders, you know, especially working with so many riders from different countries, was there something that you learned and took away from having been with that program and worked with those athletes?
Oh man, everything. I mean, I really, honestly, I look back on those 7 years as just some of the most valuable in my life. Like it really was and remains to this day, like some of the best years that I've ever had. You know, it was great to be a part of it. It was a lot of hard work. It was a lot of sacrifice, but it was huge rewards. And, you know, it was something that, you know, my heart was in, and I still believe in it to this day, you know. And it's like, just to be a part of it was so incredible. And then, you know, that thing where it was a development team. So like I'm watching, I was in a really unique position to watch these guys come in, you know, super young, and like watching them learn to race bikes. And, you know, there was room for me to make mistakes as a mechanic, because like I wasn't long into my career as a race mechanic when I started there. So like, yeah, I mean, I made some mistakes. Like not to put myself down, but like I remember I think it was Ryan Easton, I grabbed the wrong bike off the top of the car at a race one time and handed it to him. And it was just, you know, like little things like that. But it was so nice because we could all learn, you know. It wasn't like, there was an opportunity for that. And it was sort of the mentality of like, as long as we are learning from the mistakes, then they're not really mistakes, right? They're just learning experiences. So, you know, it was valuable in so many ways. And for the way the team was set up and for what it did for, you know, not only the riders, but all of everybody else that was involved in it, you know. And like, as the team grew and the staff got bigger, you know, and we added Jim Anderson and we added Trey Weideman, like as those guys came into the team, and like then Reed and I became more of like a, you know, I kind of slipped into like a head mechanic position and sort of started teaching the mechanics that would come work with me. And like, I mean, that's when you really start to learn stuff, and I think you really start to get good at the job. So, I mean, that environment that was created was just, it's really like, I wish I could say it's something you can do and that it'll continue, but I don't know if it's just such a rare thing to find that type of collection of people all in the right, in the same mindset, headed in the same direction.
Well, it's funny. It just dawned on me, you know, kind of going back to that question of, is there certain characteristics that you see in these riders developing? And I recently listened to a podcast with Teo talking about, you know, going to the final time trial in the Giro, and he was asked if he was nervous, and he said, no, I wasn't nervous because I've been practicing for this moment my whole life. And maybe the riders who are at that program who use every opportunity to learn something and to make mistakes and use those mistakes to actually get better, maybe those are the riders that do go on to achieve great success because they're always trying to learn and, you know, get better and not beat themselves up and actually progress as an athlete.
Yeah. I mean, you sort of like fill your backpack with experience, right? And then when you get to that moment where, like, you know, like for example, like Teo going into that final time trial, like, you know, it's good to be nervous. It means you care. But when it's not a new situation to you, when you've been under pressure and you've been under high stress situations, you know, I mean, think about like what these guys were doing. Like, you remember back to, you know, Lawson when he was in the Young Riders jersey at California and needed to put in a good ride to hang on to it. And, you know, Nielsen Paulus and some of the rides he had at California in those years. And, you know, when Jonathan Narvez was with us and he was leading races in France and in the leaders jersey. And, you know, like these guys, everybody got such great experience in these high pressure, high stress situations. But then again, like the first time we went through them as a rider in Axel's program, it was okay if they didn't come out on top, right? So like the pressure was there, the stress was there, but it was an opportunity again to have that experience without the pink jersey hanging on it, you know, like there was important stuff, of course, but like, you know, it's obviously different when you're 19, 20, 21 years old, like just at the beginning of your career than when you're, you know, 25, 26, 30 years old and starting to get into these grand tour situations where the pressure and the stress is so incredibly high.
Yeah. Well, I think we just answered the question of yeah, finding the characteristics of people who go on to be successful is they're willing to learn from their mistakes. Well, since I have you here, Eric, I have one question for you about being a mechanic. And this is something that, you know, we've spoken about before, but, you know, I'm sure people who are listening, you know, you go into a bike shop, what is like the one question as a mechanic that you hate answering, or just a question that's going to, you walk into a bike shop and you ask something and the mechanic's instantly going to be like, oh geez, I don't want to work on this bike. I mean, there's gotta be something that you're like, I don't want to deal with this.
Oh, I mean, honestly, like, can I have the labor for free? I mean, I don't know, honestly, like I was thinking about that and it's, I don't know that there was ever like one thing that drove me crazy. I think it was just when I felt like the work that I was doing wasn't respected, that was always a little bit tough, you know, like as long as guys were, you know, like to me, it's like, especially, you know, it's obviously different in a bike shop than it is in a team, right? Like in the team environment, like I think the most important thing is just that mutual respect. You know, it's like the mechanics understand that these athletes have been, you know, training their entire life, really, like, because years build on years build on years of training. And, you know, if you are careless with your job as a mechanic and you make a mistake that costs them a race when they're at their fitness peak, and I mean, you're not going to win a race for a rider as a mechanic, but you can pretty quickly lose a race for them. So, you know, having that respect for the position and then the riders giving the same respect back to the mechanics in the fact that they know that we're working hard, we're going to do our best for them and, you know, give them a perfect bike every day. Like I think that's the important part, you know, and obviously like in the racing team, like the questions that drove me crazy were the ones at the very last minute before the race, you know, like the morning of the race, like, hey, can I change the cassette? Can we change this? Can we change that? Can we do this or that? And in the last minutes, it's, you know, those things kind of pile up and get frustrating. But for the most part, as long as the communication's good and as long as, you know, everybody's kind of talking and on the same page, I never found myself like frustrated with a specific question.
What about my bike's creaking? Then you ask where and you say, I don't know. It's just creaking.
Oh, yeah, that's normal though.
I don't know. I mean, just fix it.
Look, if you're a mechanic going to get frustrated by a question like that, you might want to find a different line of work because that's the story of the job, man.
Yeah. Like, cool, Eric. You
know, my bike's making a weird noise.
Yeah. That's I don't know where it's coming from. Yeah. Well, thankfully none of my bikes at the moment are creaking. So I don't have any more questions for you, but hey, Eric, thank you so much for coming on and, looking forward to catching up at some point soon. Reed and hopefully Axel listen to this and can reminisce on some great times and athletes from that program keep coming so we can keep seeing them win at the top level.
Yeah. You know, we should do aside from this breakfast one, we should do a happy hour one with Axel and Reed and I, and we can sit around and reminisce over a bottle of whiskey or something about all the stories. That would be a pretty fun time.
Yeah. Tell all the stories about what you guys talked about us when we were fast asleep and you guys were out, you know, cleaning up after us and getting ready for the next stage.
Oh man, there were some good conversations in the cars on those race days, you know?
I bet there were. Awesome. Thanks so much, Eric.
Absolutely.
Well, there we have it, folks. Another episode of Breakfast with Boz being served by Wahoo. I hope you enjoyed the episode today and my conversations with Reed and Eric. I will be back next week speaking to some gravel event promoters around the U.S. and getting some insight into how they're planning to safely run their events in 2021. And to that, a final reminder to let me know of your 2021 goals and ambitions. You can find that over at wahoofitness.com, discover page, Breakfast with Boz, and in the header, you will see a link to a short survey. So until next week, folks, stay safe, stay healthy, and I'll catch you all right here next week on Breakfast with Boz being served by Wahoo.